Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hey there, welcome back. Yet another episode of Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. And this week, I hope to really lift your spirits because my topic is low points in your life. You're going, huh? That sounds depressing. Well, yes, it is, but there are silver linings, and that's kind of what we're going to focus on because my feeling is, look, we all experience low periods in our life. Certainly these last 2 years, or five if you want to count the Trump presidency like I do. But this was more of a shared low experience, okay? Now, there are low periods of your life, which is what we're going to talk about. And then there are horrendous periods. We have terrible sickness, you lose loved ones, catastrophic loss of property, your home is destroyed in a hurricane, whatever. And I would tend to categorize these as more of crises than low periods in your life. So A, I'm hoping that's not you. And B, I'm going to be talking about these low points, when you go through terrible slumps, when you can't get a job, when you have a bad breakup, when you have a loss of confidence, when you're coping with depression, that type of thing. And I don't know anybody who hasn't experienced some form of that, even very successful people. You know, you think that certain people lead charmed lives. They don't. There's always stuff that they have to cope with. I myself consider myself a very successful person. I also consider myself extremely lucky. And yet, I have had more than enough of these rough patches. But often, when I look back, I see that a lot of good came out of them. Now, I didn't realize it at the time. At the time, I was just miserable. But upon reflection, you know, I saw that, yeah, there were some silver linings to this experience. So that's what I'm going to talk about this week, a few of my rough periods and how I was able to come out of those with, you know, certain growth opportunities, certain things that guided my career and my life in a certain direction that would not have gone in that direction had it not been for this rough patch. So, see, it is ultimately going to be uplifting, okay? Okay, first one for me is the Army. And I've told this story before, but you go back to 1969, and we were in Vietnam, and they were calling up just about every young man they possibly could. And to make it quote-unquote fair, they set up a lottery. And what they did is they had 365 ping-pong balls with birth dates, January 1, January 2, January 3, et cetera, et cetera. And they selected those balls at random. Just like your, TV lottery that your state might have. And if you were, selected 1 through, 130, you were pretty much guaranteed that you were going to be drafted. From, 131 to, 211, you were in the iffy stage. They might call you, they might not. Beyond that, you were safe. Okay, so if you had a number of 278 or 331, you were not going to go in the Army. You were absolutely golden. My draft number was 4. That's right, 4. Well, needless to say, that night I was apoplectic because, Vietnam? Yikes. Me? Me, a soldier? Yikes. And so I was able to get myself into a reserve unit, an Armed Forces Radio Reserve Unit. At the time, I was a sports intern at KMPC Radio, and Roger Carroll, one of the disc jockeys, was also one of the disc jockeys for Armed Forces Radio. So he was able to get me in. And so that's the good news. And the bad news is, if you were, and I guess it's still the same today, in the reserves, here's what that commitment meant. Number one, 6 months of active duty. You had to go through regular basic training just like everybody else. Then you had 3 months of individual training for whatever your specialty was, which could be infantryman or, in my case, public information officer. Then you had 2 weeks of Army on-duty summer camp. And then you had 16 hours a month of meetings. And those were usually either a weekend of Saturday and Sunday once a month, or in the case of my unit, 1 Saturday and 2 Thursday nights from 7 until 11. And here's the kicker with this. The commitment was for 6 years. And what was always hanging over your head was the fact that you could get called up at any time. And this has happened quite a bit. It happened a lot in Korea. It happened a lot in Desert Storm, where reserve units get called up to active duty. So if there is some skirmish anywhere in the world, you could wind up in Jordan or Yemen, Bosnia, wherever. You have no say in it. And this ticking time clock is hanging over your head for 6 full years. So there's a lot of anxiety that comes about as a result. Like I said, I had to go through basic training, which for me, because I'm uncoordinated, I'm not athletic, I don't know how to build anything or take apart guns or set up tent shelters, and I don't know what entrenching tools are for. I was the worst. It was miserable. Plus, I'm an L.A. kid. I'm used to the sunshine. I got sent to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, which is on the top of the Ozarks in the winter. And the snow is howling, and you're on some rifle range. And, of course, it being the Army, the menu is the same for every Army unit in the country that particular day. So it's December. I'm on the rifle range. The wind is howling. There's nothing to cut off the wind. It's, wind chill factor of 4. And the dessert is ice cream. This is what we get. Okay, and it's kind of an indication of what it is like in the Army. So, I mean, that's another whole episode, is my exploits in basic training. It's a wonder that I ever graduated. But I did, and I had to put up with all of this, and you go, God, this is really horrible, especially when you consider that if I was born a day before or a day after, then I wouldn't have to go at all. You know, that those people were just sitting pretty. And, you know, they didn't worry about losing their school deferment. If they wanted to take a gap year and go off and backpack in Europe, they could do it. You know, not me. I had to be at the armory once a month, and I had to wear this short-haired wig because your hair had to be short in the army. And this was in the early 70s when everybody had those, you know, big jufros. And so, you know, I had to go through all of this where other people were spared. So needless to say, I was a little resentful. Now, looking back, number one, I met my partner, David Isaacs, in the Army. He got transferred into the same reserve unit that I was in, and we met one summer camp. I would not have started my writing partnership had I not met David. We also got the opportunity to write an episode of MASH, and we never could have written MASH with any authority had we not lived through the military experience. You know, little incidents like the ice cream when it's 0 degrees. You know, those are the kind of things that go on in the military. And if you have a certain command of the logic and the way it works, it really is a huge plus in writing a show like MASH. So we got a MASH assignment, and we did very well on that script, and so we got hired on the show, and quite honestly, MASH is what launched our career. And had we not had the opportunity to write for MASH, then, you know, who knows? It could have been 3 years writing crappy shows, and then we were done. So looking back, the Army and being draft number 4 turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me. You just don't know. Now I'm going to flash forward to horrible period number 2, and this goes back to 1973, and this is during my top 40 disc jockey era. And I was bouncing around from station to station, and I was doing all nights and then evenings in San Bernardino, sitting in this cow pasture in the middle of nowhere in the Inland Empire, making $650 a month. And I was on the radio. And I was, you know, not the greatest disc jockey in the world. I was funny, although most program directors didn't think so and said to shut up. But, I mean, you hear this voice. I don't have the classic radio voice. So I would get fired a lot. So it's 1973, and I come back from Army summer camp, and the station in San Bernardino fires me. I've been fired by a number of stations for a number of different reasons. One of the more common reasons is that the station changes ownership. The new owners come in and they listen to the talent and they go, okay, get rid of this guy. And that was what happened to me. So it's 1973 and I move back into the Marina area of Los Angeles to live with my parents to try to get another job. And the way you got a job in Top 40 radio in those days, there were trade magazines that would come out once a week that would have job opportunities listed. That WQXI in Atlanta is looking for a midday guy, and OLF in Syracuse needs somebody to work evening drive. And so you would mail off your tapes. In those times, little reel-to-reels, you had your like tape and resume, and you know, and you sent it off to these radio stations along with contact information, basically your phone number, and you waited for somebody to call. Back in those days, there was not even voicemail. So you know, forget having a phone on your person. It's not like, well, you can just go out for the day and do whatever you want, and then you come back at 3 p.m. and check your messages, and, oh, the station in Omaha called. Oh, I'll call him back tonight, or I'll call him back in the morning. No, you had to actually be there to take the call. So for months, my routine was going to the mailbox and applying for these jobs and then coming back to my parents' condo and sitting all day long waiting for the phone to ring, and it never did. It never did. Meanwhile, watching television, daytime television, I imagine it's very similar, although you have way more options now. But like back in those days, you know, you only had a few channels. And when you're watching those daytime soap operas and game shows and reruns of old sitcoms, the basic message that they are sending you, somewhat subliminally, but over and over and over again, is you are a loser. All of these commercials were for these fly-by-night trade schools, or, hey, you can get a loan so that you can make your bail, or, hey, housewives, have you tried Duncan Hines cake mix? Your little hubby is going to love if you make him a cake. And you're just going, oh, my God, I could see why people want to kill themselves watching daytime television. So that was my life for like months and months, because I was not getting anything. The closest I came, there was an all-night position at KYNO in Fresno. All nights in Fresno. And this program director slash asshole kept me on the hook for 6 weeks. He wasn't sure. He heard the tape again. He liked it, but didn't like it. The bottom line is, he was hoping that somebody else would send a tape that he liked better and could just hire him. And that's eventually what happened, but it took 6 weeks. And, you know, you talk about being crushed when you go, my God, if I can't get a fucking job doing all nights in Fresno, what kind of future do I have in this radio career? So I was pretty depressed about that. And kind of my only salvation, actually two things were my salvation. Number one, there was a revival theater nearby called the Fox Venice. And again, we're talking in the early 70s, and this was before Turner Classic Movies or that type of thing. And the only way that you could see old movies, there were these revival houses in most cities, actually. And there's still a few. There's one in Los Angeles at the New Beverly Theater that's now owned by Quentin Tarantino. And they'll come out with a calendar every month, and usually the programs change every 2 or 3 days, and it'll be 2 Humphrey Bogart movies, and then 2 classic horror movies, and then it will be 2 Woody Allen comedies, and then it would be Lawrence of Arabia, you know, the films of David Lean, every Friday and Saturday night. And I just got used to going to the Fox Venice Theater and seeing just about anything they had. And it really opened my eyes to cinema. I mean, I saw foreign films, you know, the films that you just sort of hear about and the people that you hear about, like Truffaut and Fellini, Kurosawa. Like, what are these guys all about? Well, I found out. I went to the Fox Venice, and it was just eye-opening. I saw so many movies that I had never seen before, And of course, you know, you could see old movies on television, but they were all hacked up and there were like a million commercials. Hey, Duncan Hines. But this was kind of a revelation to me. And, you know, I'm seeing Mean Streets. Wow, this is a good movie. Who's this Martin Scorsese guy? And you say, oh, okay, I want to go see The Maltese Falcon. I haven't seen that in a long time. And it's playing with this other thing called The Big Sleep. I don't know what The Big Sleep is, but it's a double bill. Usually these are double bills. So I'll go see that. And The Big Sleep is, like, fantastic. It's, like, the best Philip Marlowe noir movie there is. And I never would have stumbled upon it had it not been for the Fox Venice Theater. So I would do that at night. And the other thing is I called David Isaacs and said, hey, remember me as the guy that you met in summer camp? You want to try writing a script? And so David and I began our partnership. And he had a job at the time. He was working at ABC in the film can division. And so he and I would get together every Sunday and we would try writing a pilot. We knew nothing about writing or structure or anything, but we had a good time and at least it was something to do. After months of this, my father came to me one day, God bless him, and said, get a fucking job. Get any kind of job. As his feeling was, and this was the big takeaway for me, you make your own momentum, okay? If you're working on something, then you never know where it will lead or something else will break. But you have to be proactive. You have to try to generate your own momentum. And this is really true no matter what you do. I mean, if you're trying to be a writer, you write your spec script, and if you just send it around and then spend the rest of your life playing video games, waiting for someone to hire you, you're not going to make it. You have to just keep writing and writing and networking and doing whatever you can. So so I thought, okay, you know, radio wasn't going that well for me. And I applied a number of ad agencies, see if I could get into advertising, you know, become a copywriter. I wasn't particularly excited about this because at the time, and it may have been a stereotype, but at the time, it appeared that advertising was this world of crushing pressure and that ad executives, madmen, all had ulcers. That was the big expression, ulcers. Everybody has ulcers if you're working at J. Walter Thompson. So I tried out for that. A number of places had me write sample copy. Apparently I'm not good at that because nobody hired me. And eventually I was able to get a job. It was temporary, but it was a job at NBC in Burbank in the research department during pilot season because they needed extra help. They were pilot testing everything, and there was a lot of data that came through, and I was a psychology major at UCLA. You know, again, how do these things play out? Okay, when I got into UCLA, I thought, oh, okay, I'm going to go into the radio TV department. And my father, again, God bless him, said, you know, everything you can learn about radio TV, you'll learn when you get the job. You're in an academic situation. Take advantage of it. Take an academic course load. So I was interested in psychology. That's what I took. I majored in psychology. I have my BA in psychology from UCLA. And it helped me get this job because I had a background in statistics. It also helped me write Frasier and Lilith, so you never really know. So now I'm working at NBC Burbank, and I'm there about a month, and wouldn't you know, I finally get a call. A station wants me. And the station is WDRQ in Detroit. Now you're going, oh boy, Detroit, ugh. Well, Detroit is like a top 10 market. And this was 6 to 10 at night. This wasn't the all-night show. And this was paying a heck of a lot more than KYNO in Fresno would pay. And so I took that job. Now, again, it just goes to show you that, you know, I know your confidence, you know, your ego is horribly bruised, but it's also subjective. So here I am, unable to get a job doing all nights in Fresno, and yet a major market like Detroit thinks I'm good enough for a prime shift. You just never know. You have to hang in there. So that is what lifted me out of that period. And then after about a year of bouncing around from station to station again, although this time they were major market stations, but hearing the same thing, shut up, stop trying to be funny, just play the records. After that, I finally decided, screw it. I'm going to go back to L.A. and my sole objective is to try to break into television writing. I'll just get a job doing anything. I don't care as long as it's 9 to 5 and David and I can work seriously, like several nights a week and weekends on writing spec scripts so that I can break into the industry. Now, you would think, okay, here comes another down period. You know, you got a crappy job. I was teaching broadcasting at one of those fly-by-night trade schools that advertised on daytime television, living in a crummy apartment, hardly any money at all. I was not in a relationship at the time. So you would think, man, okay, this is like another depressing period. I tell you what, it was anything but, because I was so excited at the prospect of wanting to break into television. It's like, this is, now I know what I want to do, and it is this. And at the time, television comedy was really at an apex. You had the Mary Tyler Moore Show and All in the Family and MASH and Maude and Rhoda and The Odd Couple. So it was a great time to try to break in. The standards were very high, but it was also very inspiring. So I enjoyed that period. I probably would not have enjoyed it if it lasted 7 years and I didn't break in. But at least during that stretch when I was quote-unquote struggling, I was very energized, and so I don't count that as a horrible time in my life. Now, I am going to talk about the time that I thought my career was over. Now we go to 1986, and David and I created a show for Mary Tyler Moore called Mary. And I just want to say at this point that it was a major struggle for a number of reasons. You know, not saying that we're not to blame for some of those reasons, but I'll just say that that is a separate saga, which I am saving for the book that I'm going to write one day. For our purposes today, suffice to say that it was a struggle. David and I and our writing staff, although mostly David and I, were literally writing around the clock for like 5-6 months. When I say literally, I mean we'd be writing until 5-6 o'clock in the morning and sleep a couple hours in the office, and then be down on the stage at 9 o'clock for the start of another day. And it went on like this over and over and over again, writing weekends. This lasted for like about 6 months. And when it was finally over, we were burned out. I was like just a shell. You know, it's like one of those old, you know, beat up and battered soldiers coming back from the Civil War. That was me and my partner. And for like 3-4 months, I did nothing. I couldn't write a laundry list. I had no idea, no ideas in my head for things to write. Certainly no ideas for comedies. I was just a shell, just kind of wandering around. I don't even remember what I did during those 3-month periods. But that was really terrible. Now it's summer and shows are back and they're in pre-production. We get a call from the Charles Brothers saying, "Hey, you guys want to write an episode of Cheers?" And we had nothing else to do. And we was like, can we write an episode? I guess so. So we went down and we met with them and we talked out a story. And as the story progressed, it turned into a two-parter because there was just too much of the story for one part. And for you Cheers aficionados, this was the two-parter called Never Love a Goalie, and it was the episodes that introduced the Jay Thomas character, Eddie LeBeck, into the Cheers world and you know, his relationship with Carla. So we work out the story, and we work out an outline, and they say, okay, go off and write it. We say, well, the way we usually write is we have like a secretary or a writer's assistant take down the dictation, and we dictate the scripts. And Les said, well, okay, you can use one of our writer's assistants, and you can use my office because I'm not in my office very often. So we had an office and an assistant, and we were going to start writing the script on a Monday morning. I'm driving to Paramount that Monday, and it's about a 20-minute drive. And I'm thinking to myself, can we do this? Seriously, are we up for this? And at the time, I thought, you know, there's maybe better than a 50-50 chance that David and I are just going to sit there all day long and finally, at the end of the day, have to go to Glenn and Les and say, we can't do this. You're going to have to get somebody else to write the episode. That we're done. You know, it's like, you know, time to find another career. So that's a certain amount of anxiety hanging over my head as I entered the studio that Monday morning. So David and I get together and writer's assistant comes in. And again, we don't know this person. He doesn't know us. It's like, okay, you two geniuses, what do you got? You know, he sits there with his steno pad, kind of looking at us like, talk to me, make me laugh, start saying funny things. And he, at first, it was kind of debilitating. And David and I were just sort of sitting there looking at each other. And then we just, all right, well, let's get into it. Interior bar day. Sam and the regulars are there. You know, Cliff enters, blah, blah, blah. And kind of we're thinking, and we came up with a joke, and David came up with another joke, and I came up with a joke, and we're like, oh, okay, we could do that, we could do this, and all right, well, let's go with that. And slowly, over the course of like a half an hour, we felt it was coming back. And the only way I can describe that is like in those Superman movies and episodes of TV where he's relieved of the kryptonite. The kryptonite is taken away, and slowly his powers start returning. And that's the way we felt. And by lunchtime, like, we were back. And I have to tell you, I have never, ever been more relieved in my life than I was that day. And the fact that, no, we haven't lost it, that it's the ability that stays with you. So that was certainly a silver lining. Another silver lining to that situation was David and I learned an awful lot about becoming showrunners. And when we got the opportunity in subsequent shows to be showrunners, man, we ran those shows so much better. And if I can go off on a brief tangent for a moment, the first pilot we did, this was a multi-camera pilot for NBC called Characters in 1979, and the show didn't go. And a few years later, David and I joined Cheers, the first season, and working with Glenn and Les Charles. And we saw the way they handled problems, and there were things that came up that David and I didn't even recognize as problems that they did, and they knew how to handle it. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, if they had picked up our show, if NBC had gone with our show back in 1979, we would have been buried. We were not at all prepared to really run a show and to deal with the 9,000 problems and issues and fires that you have to put out. It was an eye-opening. Well, we got that basic training education on The Mary Show, and it made running shows ourselves way easier. And then the final benefit is, this is when I had that kind of midlife crisis and said, okay, what else is there? And I went back to my original childhood dream that I had never really surrendered, which was to be a Major League Baseball play-by-play announcer. And I said, okay, if I don't pursue it now, I never will. And that's when I went to the upper deck of Dodger Stadium with a tape recorder and began calling games. Partly it was after a year of being locked in a room for 16 hours a day, just to be at a stadium and be outside and have there be lots of people and noise and cheering and happy people eating hot dogs and drinking beer. They were all happy. This was a wonderful environment for me. So without that Mary experience, which granted was very tough, and at the time I was just going, make it stop. But looking back, I never would have had a baseball career had it not been for that. So those are a few personal examples of how you can deal with tough situations. You do come out of them, and hopefully along the way, you were able to bring some good things that you were able to use later. All right. Was that inspiring? Was that inspiring enough? Okay, you're probably depressed. Anyway, thanks for listening. That'll do it. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister, Butler, Howard Hoffman, to John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. I am available via email if you want to get in touch, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. I am also on Twitter at Ken Levine, and I'm on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. If you haven't already, please subscribe. I shamelessly would love a 5-star or 12-star review. And I'll be back next week with more nonsense right here on
Hollywood and Levine.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.